he realized that these very cousins could probably have gotten him laid if only he'd bothered to hang out with them. But you can't regret the life you didn't lead. In the afternoons, when he couldn't write another word, he'd sit out in front of the house with his abuela and watch the street scene, listen to the raucous exchanges between the neighbors. One evening at the end of his trip, his abuela confided, "Your mother could have been a doctor just like your grandfather was." "What happened?" La Inca shook her head. She was looking at her favorite picture of his mother on her first day at private school, one of those typical serious DR shots.
"What always happens?"
"Un maldito hombre."
He wrote two books that summer, about a young man fighting mutants at the end of the world. Neither of them survive. Took crazy amounts of field notes, too, names of things he intended to later adapt for science fictional and fantastic purposes. Heard about the family curse for like the 1,000th time, but strangely enough didn't think it worth incorporating into his fiction. I mean, shit, what Latino family doesn't think it's cursed? When it was time for him and his sister to return to Patterson, he was almost sad. Almost. His abuela placed her hand on his head in blessing.
"Cuídate mucho, mi hijo.
Know that in this world there is somebody who will always love you."
At JFK, almost not being recognized by his uncle. "Great," his tío said, looking askance at his complexion. "Now you look Haitian." After his return, he hung out with Miggs and Al, saw movies with them, talked Los Brothers Hernandez, Frank Miller, and Alan Moore with them, but overall they never regained the friendship they had before Santo Domingo. Oscar listened to their messages on the machine and resisted the urge to run over to their places. Didn't see them but once, twice a week. Focused on his writing. Those were some fucking lonely weeks when all he had were his games, his books, and his words.
"So now I have a hermit for a son,"
his mother complained bitterly. At night, unable to sleep, he watched a lot of bad TV, became obsessed with two movies in particular. Zardoz, which he'd seen with his uncle before they put him away for the second time, and Virus, the Japanese end-of-the-world movie with the hot chick from Romeo and Juliet. Virus especially he could not watch to the end without crying. The Japanese hero arriving at the South Pole base, having walked from Washington, D.C., down the whole spine of the Andes for the woman of his dreams. "I've been working on my fifth novel," he told the boys when they asked about his absences. "It's amazing."
"See? What did I tell you, Mr. College Boy?"
In the old days, when his so-called friends would hurt him or drag his trust through the mud, he always crawled voluntarily back into the abuse out of fear and loneliness, something he'd always hated himself for, but not this time. If there existed in his high school years any one moment he took pride in, it was clearly this one. Even told his sister about it during her next visit. She said,
"Way to go, oh!"
He'd finally showed some backbone, hence some pride. And although it hurt, it also felt motherfucking good. Oscar comes close. In October, after all his college applications were in, Fairleigh Dickinson, Montclair, Rutgers, Drew, Glassboro State, William Patterson. He also sent an app to NYU, a one-in-a-million shot. And they rejected him so fast he was amazed the shit hadn't come back Pony Express. And winter was settling its pale, miserable ass across northern New Jersey. Oscar fell in love with a girl in his SAT prep class. The class was being conducted in one of those learning centers, not far from where he lived, less than a mile. So he'd been walking, a healthy way to lose weight, he thought. He hadn't been expecting to meet anyone. But then he'd seen the beauty in the back row and felt his senses fly out of him. Her name was Ana Obregón, a pretty, loud-mouthed gordita who read Henry Miller while she should have been learning to wrestle logic problems. On about their fifth class, he noticed her reading Sexus, and she noticed him noticing, And leaning over, she showed him a passage, and he got an erection like a motherfucker. "You must think I'm weird, right?" she said during the break. "You ain't weird," he said. "Believe me, I'm the top expert in the state." Anna was a talker, had beautiful Caribbean girl eyes, pure anthracite, and was the sort of heavy that almost every island nigga dug. A body that you just knew would look good in and out of clothes. Wasn't shy about her weight either. She wore tight black stirrup pants like every other girl in the neighborhood, and the sexiest underwear she could afford, and was a meticulous putter-on of makeup, an intricate bit of multitasking for which Oscar never lost his fascination. She was this peculiar combination of bad mash and little girl. Even before he'd visited her house, he knew she'd have a whole collection of stuffed animals avalanched on her bed, and there was something in the seamlessness with which she switched between these aspects that convinced him that both were masks, that there existed a third Anna, a hidden Anna who determined what mask to throw up for what occasion, but who was otherwise obscure and impossible to know. She'd gotten into Miller because her ex-boyfriend Manny had given her the books before he joined the army. He used to read passages to her all the time. "That made me so hot." She'd been 13 when they started dating. He was 24, a recovering coke addict. Anna talking about these things like they weren't nothing at all. "You were 13 and your mother allowed you to date a septuagenarian?" "My parents loved Manny," she said. "My mom used to cook dinner for him all the time." He said, "That seems highly unorthodox." And later at home, he asked his sister, back on winter break, "For the sake of argument, would you allow your pubescent daughter to have relations with a 24-year-old male?" "I'd kill him first." He was amazed how relieved he felt to hear that. "Let me guess. You know somebody who's doing this?" He nodded. "She sits next to me in SAT class. I think she's orchidaceous." Lola considered him with her tiger-colored irises. She'd been back a week, and it was clear that college-level track was kicking her ass. The sclera in her normally wide manga eyes were shot through with blood vessels. "You know," she said finally, "we colored folks talk plenty of shit about loving our children, but we really don't." She exhaled. "We don't. We don't. We don't." He tried to put a hand on his sister's shoulder, but she shrugged it off. "You better go bust out some crunches, mister." That's what she called him whenever she was feeling tender or wronged. "Mister." Later she'd want to put that on his gravestone, but no one would let her. Not even me. Stupid. Amor de pendejo. He and Anna in SAT class. He and Anna in the parking lot afterward. He and Anna at the McDonald's. He and Anna become friends. Each day, Oscar expected her to be adios. Each day, she was still there. They got into the habit of talking on the phone a couple of times a week, about nothing really, spinning words out of their everyday. The first time she called him, offering him a ride to SAT class. A week later, he called her, just to try it. His heart beating so hard, he thought he would die, but all she did when she picked up was say, "Oscar, listen to the bullshit my sister pulled." And off they'd gone, building another one of their word scrapers. By the fifth time he called, he no longer expected the big blow-off. She was the only girl outside his family who admitted to having a period, who actually said to him, "I'm bleeding like a hog." An astounding confidence he turned over and over in his head, sure it meant something, and when he thought about the way she laughed, as though she owned the air around her, his heart thudded inside his chest, a lonely rata. Ana Obregón, unlike every other girl in his secret cosmology, he actually fell for as they were getting to know each other. Because her appearance in his life was sudden, because she'd come in under his radar. He didn't have time to raise his usual wall of nonsense or level some wild-ass expectations her way. Maybe he was plain tired after 4 years of not getting ass, or maybe he'd finally found his zone. Incredibly enough, instead of making an idiot out of himself as one might have expected, given the hard fact that this was the first girl he'd ever had a conversation with, he actually took it a day at a time. He spoke to her plainly and without effort, and discovered that his constant self-deprecation pleased her immensely. It was amazing how it was between them. He would say something obvious and uninspired, and she'd say, "Oscar, you're really fucking smart." When she said, "I love men's hands," he spread both of his across his face and said, faux casual-like, "Oh, really?" It cracked her up. She never talked about what they were. She only said, "Man, I'm glad I got to know you." And he said, "I'm glad I'm me knowing you." One night, while he was listening to New Order and trying to chug through Clay's Ark, his sister knocked on his door. "You got a visitor."
"I do?"
"Yup." Lola leaned against his doorframe. She'd shaved her head down to the bone, Sinead style, and now everybody, including their mother, was convinced she'd turned into a lesbiana. "You might want to clean up a little." She touched his face gently. "Shave those pussy hairs." It was Anna, standing in his foyer, wearing a full-length leather, her trigueña skin blood-charged from the cold, her face gorgeous with eyeliner, mascara, foundation, lipstick, and blush. "Freezing out," she said. She had her gloves in one hand like a crumpled bouquet. "Hey," was all he managed to say. He could hear his sister upstairs listening. "What you doing?" Anna asked.
"Like nothing."
"Like, let's go to a movie then."
"Like, okay," he said.
Upstairs, his sister was jumping up and down on his bed, low screaming, "It's a date, it's a date." And then she jumped on his back and nearly toppled them clean through the bedroom window.
"So is this some kind of date?"
he said, as he slipped into her car. She smiled wanly.
"You could call it that."
Anna drove a Cressida, and instead of taking them to the local theater, she headed down to the Amboy Multiplex. "I love this place," she said, as she was wrangling for a parking space. "My father used to take us here when it was still a drive-in."
"Did you ever come here back then?"
He shook his head.
"Though I heard they steal plenty of cars here now."
"Nobody's stealing this baby."
It was so hard to believe what was happening that Oscar really couldn't take it seriously.
The whole time the movie, Manhunter, was on, he kept expecting niggas to jump out with cameras and scream, "Surprise!" "Boy," he said, trying to remain on her map, "this is some movie." Anna nodded. She smelled of some perfume he could not name, and when she pressed close, the heat off her body was vertiginous. On the ride home, Anna complained about having a headache, and they didn't speak for a long time. He tried to turn on the radio, but she said, "No, my head's really killing me." He joked, "Would you like some crack?"
"No, Oscar."
So he sat back and watched the Hess building and the rest of Woodbridge slide past through a snarl of overpasses. He was suddenly aware of how tired he was. The nervousness that had raged through him the entire night had exhausted his ass. The longer they went without speaking, the more morose he became. "It's just a movie," he told himself. "It's not like it's a date." Anna seemed unaccountably sad, and she chewed her bottom lip, a real bembe, until most of her lipstick was on her teeth. He was going to make a comment about it, but decided not to. "You reading anything good?"
"Nope,"
she said. "You?"
"I'm reading Dune."
She nodded.
"I hate that book."
They reached the Elizabeth exit, which is what New Jersey is really known for, industrial wastes on both sides of the turnpike. He had started holding his breath against those horrible fumes when Anna let loose a scream that threw him into his passenger door.
"Elizabeth!" she shrieked. "Close your fucking legs!"
Then she looked over at him, tipped back her head, and laughed. When he returned to the house, his sister said,
"Well?"
"Well what? Did you fuck her?"
"Jesus, Lola," he said, blushing.
"Don't lie to me."
"I do not move so precipitously."
He paused and then sighed.
"In other words, I didn't even get her scarf off."
"Sounds a little suspicious. I know you Dominican men."
She held up her hands and flexed the fingers in playful menace.
"Son pulpos."
The next day he woke up feeling like he'd been unshackled from his fat, like he'd been washed clean of his misery. And for a long time, he couldn't remember why he felt this way. And then he said her name.
End of Disc 1.
Oscar in Love. And so now every week they headed out to either a movie or the mall. They talked. He learned that her ex-boyfriend, Manny, used to smack the shit out of her, which was a problem, she confessed, because she liked it when guys were a little rough with her in bed. He learned that her father had died in a car accident when she was a young girl in Macorís, and that her new stepfather didn't care two shits about her, but that it didn't matter because once she got into Penn State, she didn't ever intend to come back home. In turn, he showed her some of his writings and told her about the time he'd gotten struck by a car and put in the hospital, and about how his steel used to smack the shit out of him in the old days. He even told her about the crush he had on Maritza Chacón, and she screamed,
"Maritza Chacón? I know that cuero! Oh my God, Oscar! I think even my stepfather slept with her."
Oh, they got close all right. But did they ever kiss in her car? Did he ever put his hands up her skirt? Did he ever thumb her clit? Did she ever push up against him and say his name in a throaty voice? Did he ever stroke her hair while she sucked him off? Did they ever fuck? Poor Oscar. Without even realizing it, he'd fallen into one of those let's be friends vortexes, the bane of nerd boys everywhere. These relationships were love's version of a stay in the stocks. In you go, plenty of misery guaranteed, and what you got out of it, besides bitterness and heartbreak, nobody knows. Perhaps some knowledge of self and of women. Perhaps. In April, he got his second set of SAT scores back. 1020 under the old system. And a week later, he learned he was heading to Rutgers, New Brunswick.
"Well, you did it, hijo,"
his mother said, looking more relieved than was polite. "No more selling pencils for me," he agreed. "You'll love it," his sister promised him. "I know I will. I was meant for college." As for Anna, she was on her way to Penn State, honors program, full ride.
"And now my stepfather can kiss my ass."
It was also in April that her ex-boyfriend Manny returned from the army. Anna told him during one of their trips to the Yauhan Mall. His sudden appearance, and Anna's joy over it, shattered the hopes Oscar had cultivated. "He's back?" Oscar asked. "Like, forever?" Anna nodded. Apparently Manny had gotten into trouble again. Drugs. But this time, Anna insisted, he'd been set up by these three cocolos, a word he'd never heard her use before, so he figured she'd gotten it from Manny.
"Poor Manny," she said.
"Yeah, poor Manny,"
Oscar muttered under his breath. Poor Manny, poor Anna, poor Oscar. Things changed quickly. First off, Anna stopped being home all the time, and Oscar found himself stacking messages on her machine.
This is Oscar. A bear is chewing my legs off. Please call me.
This is Oscar. They want $1 million or it's over. Please call me.
This is Oscar. I've just spotted a strange meteorite and I'm going out to investigate.
She always got back to him after a couple of days and was pleasant about it, but still. Then she canceled 3 Fridays in a row, and he had to settle for the clearly reduced berth of Sunday after church. She'd pick him up and they'd drive out to Boulevard East and park, and together they'd stare out over the Manhattan skyline. It wasn't an ocean or a mountain range. It was, at least to Oscar, better, and it inspired their best conversations. It was during one of those little chats that Anna let slip,
God, I'd forgotten how big Manny's cock was. Like I really need to hear that, he snapped.
I'm sorry, she said hesitantly. I thought we could talk about everything.
Well, it wouldn't be bad if you actually kept Manny's anatomical enormity to yourself.
So we can't talk about everything. He didn't even bother answering her.
With Manny and his big cock around, Oscar was back to dreaming about nuclear annihilation. How through some miraculous accident, he'd hear about the attack first, and without pausing, he'd steal his Tio's car, drive it to the stores, stock it full of supplies, maybe shoot a couple of looters en route, and then fetch Anna.
What about Manny? She'd wail. There's no time, he'd insist, peeling out. Shoot a couple more looters, now slightly mutated, and then repair to the sweaty love den, where Anna would quickly succumb to his take-charge genius and his by-then ectomorphic physique. When he was in a better mood, he let Anna find Manny hanging from a light fixture in his apartment, his tongue a swollen purple bladder in his mouth, his pants around his ankles. The news of the imminent attack on the TV, a half-literate note pinned to his chest.
I could not take it.
And then Oscar would comfort Anna with the terse insight. He was too weak for this hard new world.
So she has a boyfriend?
Lola asked him suddenly.
Yes, he said. You should back off for a little while.
Did he listen? Of course he didn't.
Available any time she needed to kvetch.
And he even got, joy of joys, the opportunity to meet the famous Manny, which was about as fun as being called a fag during a school assembly, which had happened. Twice. Met him outside Anna's house. He was this intense, emaciated guy with marathon runner limbs and voracious eyes. When they shook hands, Oscar was sure the nigger was going to smack him. He acted so surly. Manny was muy bald and completely shaved his head to hide it, had a hoop in each ear, and this leathery out-in-the-sun buzzardy look of an old cat straining for youth.
So you're Anna's little friend, Manny said.
That's me, Oscar said,
in a voice so full of cheerful innocuousness that he could have shot himself for it.
Oscar is a brilliant writer, Anna offered,
even though she had never once asked to read anything he wrote. He snorted.
What would you have to write about?
I'm into the more speculative genres.
He knew how absurd he sounded.
The more speculative genres.
Manny looked ready to cut a steak off him.
You sound mad corny, guy, you know that?
Oscar smiled, hoping somehow an earthquake would demolish all of Patterson.
I just hope you ain't trying to chisel in on my girl, guy.
Oscar said, ha ha. Anna flushed red, looked at the ground.
A joy.
With Manny around, he was exposed to an entirely new side of Anna. All they talked about now, the little they saw each other, was Manny and the terrible things he did to her. Manny smacked her, Manny kicked her, Manny called her a fat twat. Manny cheated on her, she was sure, with this Cuban chicky from the middle school.
So that explains why I couldn't get a date in those days. It was Manny, Oscar joked.
But Anna didn't laugh. They couldn't talk 10 minutes without Manny beeping her and her having to call him back and assure him she wasn't with anybody else. And one day, she arrived at Oscar's house with a bruise on her face and with her blouse torn, and his mother had said, "I don't want any trouble here."
"What am I going to do?"
she asked over and over, and Oscar always found himself holding her awkwardly and telling her, "Well, I think if he's this bad to you, you should break up with him." But she shook her head and said,
"I know I should, but I can't. I love him."
Love. Oscar knew he should have checked out right then. He liked to kid himself that it was only cold anthropological interest that kept him around to see how it would all end. But the truth was, he couldn't extricate himself. He was totally and irrevocably in love with Anna. What he used to feel for those girls he'd never really known was nothing compared to the amor he was carrying in his heart for Anna. It had the density of a dwarf motherfucking star, and at times he was 100% sure it would drive him mad. The only thing that came close was how he felt about his books. Only the combined love he had for everything he'd read and everything he'd hoped to write came even close. Every Dominican family has stories about crazy loves, about niggers who take love too far, and Oscar's family was no different. His abuelo, the dead one, had been unyielding about one thing or another, no one ever exactly said, and ended up in prison, first mad, then dead. His abuela Nena Inca had lost her husband 6 months after they got married. He had drowned on Semana Santa, and she never remarried. Never touched another man. "We'll be together soon enough," Oscar had heard her say. "Your mother," his tía Rubelca had once whispered, "was a loca when it came to love. It almost killed her." And now it seemed that it was Oscar's turn. "Welcome to the family," his sister said in a dream. "The real family." It was obvious what was happening, but what could he do? There was no denying what he felt. Did he lose sleep? Yes. Did he lose important hours of concentration? Yes. Did he stop reading his Andre Norton books and even lose interest in the final issues of Watchmen, which were unfolding in the illest way? Yes. Did he start borrowing his tío's car for long rides to the shore, parking at Sandy Hook, where his mom used to take them before she got sick, back when Oscar hadn't been too fat, before she stopped going to the beach altogether? Yes. Did his youthful, unrequited love cause him to lose weight? Unfortunately, this alone it did not provide, and for the life of him he couldn't understand why. When Lola had broken up with Golden Gloves, she'd lost almost 20 pounds. What kind of genetic discrimination was this, handed down by what kind of scrub god? Miraculous things started happening. Once, he blacked out while crossing an intersection and woke up with a rugby team gathered around him. Another time, Miggs was goofing on him, talking smack about his aspirations to write role-playing games. Complicated story. The company Oscar had been hoping to write for, Fantasy Games Unlimited, and which was considering one of his modules for Cyworld, had recently closed. Scuttling all of Oscar's hopes and dreams that he was about to turn into the next Gary Gygax. "Well," Mig said, "it looks like that didn't work out." And for the first time ever in their relationship, Oscar lost his temper and without a word swung on Miggs, connected so hard that homeboy's mouth spouted blood.
"Jesus Christ," Al said. "Calm down."
"I didn't mean to do it," he said unconvincingly. "It was an accident."
"Motherfuffer," Miggs said.
"Motherfuffer."
He got so bad that one desperate night, after listening to Anna sobbing to him on the phone about Manny's latest bullshit, he said, "I have to go to church now," and put down the phone, went to his tío's room. Rudolfo was out at the titty bar, and stole his antique Virginia Dragoon, that oh-so-famous First Nation exterminating Colt 44, heavier than bad luck and twice as ugly, stuck its impressive snout down the front of his pants and proceeded to stand in front of Manny's building almost the entire night. Got real friendly with the aluminum siding. "Come on, motherfucker," he said calmly. "I got a nice 11-year-old girl for you." He didn't care that he would more than likely be put away forever, or that niggas like him got ass and mouth raped in jail, or that if the cops picked him up and found the gun, they'd send Estillo's ass up the river for parole violation. He didn't care about nada that night. His head contained zero, a perfect vacuum. He saw his entire writing future flash before his eyes. He'd only written one novel worth a damn, about an Australian hunger spirit preying on a group of small-town friends. Wouldn't get a chance to write anything better. Career over. Luckily for the future of American letters, Manny did not come home that night. It was hard to explain. It wasn't just that he thought Anna was his last fucking chance for happiness. This was clearly on his mind. It was also that he'd never ever in all his miserable 18 years of life experienced anything like he'd felt when he was around that girl. "I've waited forever to be in love," he wrote his sister. "How many times I thought, this is never going to happen to me." When in his second favorite anime of all time, Robotech Macross, Rich Hunter finally hooked up with Lisa, he broke down in front of the TV and cried.
"Don't tell me they shot the president,"
his teal called from the back room where he was quietly snorting you-know-what. "It's like I swallowed a piece of heaven," he wrote to his sister in a letter. "You can't imagine how it feels." 2 days later, he broke down and confessed to his sister about the gun stuff, and she, back on a short laundry visit, flipped out. She got them both on their knees in front of the altar she'd built to their dead abuelo and had them swear on their mother's living soul that he'd never pull anything like that again as long as he lived. She even cried. She was so worried about him.
"You need to stop this, mister."
"I know I do," he said. "But I don't know if I'm even here, you know?" That night, he and his sister both fell asleep on the couch, she first. Lola had just broken up with her boyfriend for like the 10th time. But even Oscar, in his condition, knew they would be back together in no time at all. Sometime before dawn, he dreamt about all the girlfriends he'd never had, row upon row upon row upon row, like the extra bodies that the miracle people had in Alan Moore's Miracle Man. "You can do it," they said. He awoke, cold, with a dry throat. They met at the Japanese mall on Edgewater Road, Yaohan, which he had discovered one day on his long I'm bored drives, and which he now considered part of their landscape, something to tell their children about. It was where he came for his anime tapes and his mecha models. Ordered them both chicken katsu curries, and then sat in the large cafeteria with the view of Manhattan, the only gaijin in the whole joint. "You have beautiful breasts," he said as an opener. Confusion, alarm. "Oscar, what's the matter with you?" He looked out through the glass at Manhattan's western flank, looked out like he was some deep nigger. Then he told her. There were no surprises. Her eyes went soft. She put a hand on his hand. Her chair scraped closer. There was a strand of yellow in her teeth.
"Oscar," she said gently, "I have a boyfriend."
She drove him home. At the house, he thanked her for her time, walked inside, lay in bed. In June, he graduated from Don Bosco. See them at graduation. His mother starting to look thin. The cancer would grab her soon enough.
Rudolfo high as shit. Only Lola looking her best, beaming, happy.
You did it, mister. You did it.
He heard, in passing, that of everybody in their section of P-Town, only he and Olga, poor fucked-up Olga, had not attended even one prom.
Dude,
Miggs joked. Maybe you should have asked her out. In September, he headed to Rutgers, New Brunswick. His mother gave him $100 and his first kiss in 5 years. His deal? A box of condoms.
Use them all, he said.
And then added,
on girls.
There was the initial euphoria of finding himself alone at college, free of everything, completely on his fucking own, and with it an optimism that here among these thousands of young people he would find someone like him. That, alas, didn't happen. The white kids looked at his black skin and his afro and treated him with inhuman cheeriness. The kids of color, upon hearing him speak and seeing him move his body, shook their heads. You're not Dominican. And he said over and over again, but I am. Soy Dominicano. Dominicano soy. After a spate of parties that led to nothing but being threatened by some drunk white boys, and dozens of classes where not a single girl looked at him, he felt the optimism wane. And before he even realized what had happened, he had buried himself in what amounted to the college version of what he'd majored in all throughout high school. Getting no ass. His happiest moments were genre moments. Like when Akira was released, 1988. Pretty sad. Twice a week, he and his sister would dine at the Douglas Dining Hall. She was a big woman on campus, and knew just about everybody with any pigment, had her hand on every protest and every march, but that didn't help his situation any. During their get-togethers, she would give him advice, and he would nod quietly, and afterward would sit at the E-bus stop and stare at all the pretty Douglas girls and wonder where he'd gone wrong in his life. He wanted to blame the books, the sci-fi, but he couldn't. He loved them too much. Despite swearing early on to change his nerdly ways, he continued to eat, continued not to exercise, continued to use flash words, and after a couple semesters without any friends but his sister, he joined the university's resident geek organization, RU Gamers, which met in the classrooms beneath Frelinghuysen and boasted an entirely male membership. He had thought college would be better, as far as girls were concerned. But those first years, it wasn't.
Chapter 2 Wildwood, 1982 to 1985. It's never the changes we want that change everything. This is how it all starts. With your mother calling you into the bathroom, you will remember what you were doing at that precise moment for the rest of your life. You were reading Watership Down, and the rabbits and their does were making their dash for the boat, and you didn't want to stop reading. The book has to go back to your brother tomorrow. But then she called you again, louder, her I'm not fucking around voice, and you mumbled irritably, Sí, señora. She was standing in front of the medicine cabinet mirror, naked from the waist up, her bra slung about her waist like a torn sail. The scar on her back is vast and inconsolable as a sea. You want to return to your book, to pretend you didn't hear her, but it is too late. Her eyes meet yours, the same big, smoky eyes you will have in the future. Ven acá, she commanded. She is frowning at something on one of her breasts. Your mother's breasts are immensities, one of the wonders of the world. The only ones you've seen that are bigger are in nudie magazines or on really fat ladies. They're 35 triple Ds, and the aureoles are as big as saucers and black as pitch, and at their edges are fierce hairs that sometimes she plucked and sometimes she didn't. These breasts have always embarrassed you, and when you walk in public with her, you are always conscious of them. After her face and her hair, her chest is what she is most proud of. Your father could never get enough of them, she always brags. But given the fact that he ran off on her after their third year of marriage, it seemed in the end that he could. You dread conversations with your mother. Those one-sided dressing downs. You figured that she has called you in to give you another earful about your diet. Your mom's convinced that if you eat more plátanos, you will suddenly acquire her same extraordinary, train-wrecking, secondary sex characteristics. Even at that age, you were nothing if not your mother's daughter. You were 12 years old, and already as tall as she was. A long, slender-necked ibis of a girl. You had her green eyes, clearer though, and her straight hair, which makes you look more Hindu than Dominican, and a behind that the boys haven't been able to stop talking about since fifth grade, and whose appeal you do not yet understand. You have her complexion, too, which means you are dark. But for all your similarities, the tides of inheritance have yet to reach your chest. You have only the slightest hint of breast. From most angles, you're flat as a board, and you're thinking she's going to order you to stop wearing bras again because they're suffocating your potential breasts, discouraging them from popping out of you. You're ready to argue with her to the death, because you're as possessive of your bras as you are of the pads you now buy yourself. But no, she doesn't say a word about eating more plátanos. Instead, she takes your right hand and guides you. Your mom is rough in all things, but this time, she is gentle. You did not think her capable of it. Did you feel that? She asks in her too familiar raspy voice. At first, all you feel is the heat of her and the density of the tissue, like a bread that never stopped rising. She kneads your fingers into her. You're as close as you've ever been, and your breathing is what you hear. Don't you feel that? She turns toward you. Coño, muchacha, stop looking at me and feel. So you close your eyes, and your fingers are pushing down, and you're thinking of Helen Keller, and how when you were little you wanted to be her, except more nunnish. And then suddenly, without warning, you do feel something. A knot just beneath her skin, tight and secretive as a plot. And at that moment, for reasons you will never quite understand, you are overcome by the feeling, the premonition, that something in your life is about to change. You become lightheaded, and you can feel a throbbing in your blood, a beat, a rhythm, a drum. Bright lights zoom through you like photon torpedoes, like comets. You don't know how or why you know this thing, but you know it cannot be doubted. It is exhilarating. For as long as you've been alive, you've had bruja ways. Even your mother will begrudge you that much. Hija de Liborio, she called you after you picked your tía's winning numbers for her, and you assumed Liborio was a relative. That was before Santo Domingo, before you knew about the great power of God. I feel it, you say, too loudly. Lo siento. And like that, everything changes. Before the winter is out, the doctors remove that breast you were needing, along with the axillary lymph node. Because of the operation, she will have trouble lifting her arm over her head for the rest of her life. Her hair begins to fall out, and one day she pulls it all out herself and puts it inside a plastic bag. You change too. Not right away, but it happens. And it's in that bathroom where it all begins. Where you begin. A punk chick. That's what I became. A Susie and the Banshees loving punk chick. The Puerto Rican kids on the block couldn't stop laughing when they saw my hair. They called me Blacula. And the Morenos, they didn't know what to say. They just called me Devil Bitch. Yo, Devil Bitch. Yo, yo. My tía Rubelka thought it was some kind of mental illness. Hija, she said while frying pastelitos. Maybe you need help. but my mother was the worst. "It's the last straw," she screamed. "The last straw." But it always was with her. Mornings when I came downstairs, she'd be in the kitchen making her coffee in La Greca and listening to radio WADO. And when she saw me and my hair, she'd get mad all over again, as if during the night she'd forgotten who I was. My mother was one of the tallest women in Patterson, and her anger was just as tall. It pincered you in its long arms, and if you showed any weakness, you were finished. "Qué muchacha tan fea," she said in disgust, splashing the rest of her coffee in the sink. Fea's become my new name. Nothing new, really. She's been saying stuff like that all our lives. My mother would never win any awards, believe me. You could call her an absentee parent. If she wasn't at work, she was sleeping. And when she was around, it seemed all she did was scream and hit. As kids, me and Oscar were more scared of our mother than we were of the dark or el cucú. She would hit us anywhere, in front of anyone, always free with the chanclas and the correa. But now with her cancer, there's not much she can do anymore. The last time she tried to wail on me, it was because of my hair. But instead of cringing or running, I punched her hand. It was a reflex more than anything. But once it happened, I knew I couldn't take it back. Not ever. And so I just kept my fist clenched, waiting for whatever came next. For her to attack me with her teeth like she did to this one lady in the pathmark. But she just stood there, shaking, in her stupid wig and her stupid bata, with two huge foam prostheses in her bra, the smell of burning wig all around us. I almost felt sorry for her. "This is how you treat your mother?" she cried. And if I could have, I would have broken the entire length of my life across her face. But instead I screamed back, "And this is how you treat your daughter?" Things had been bad between us all year. How could they not have been? She was my old-world Dominican mother, and I was her only daughter. The one she had raised up herself with the help of nobody, which meant it was her duty to keep me crushed under her heel. I was 14, and desperate for my own patch of world that had nothing to do with her. I wanted the life that I used to see when I watched Big Blue Marble as a kid. The life that drove me to make pen pals and to take atlases home from school. The life that existed beyond Patterson, beyond my family, beyond Spanish. And as soon as she became sick, I saw my chance. And I'm not going to pretend or apologize. I saw my chance, and eventually, I took it. If you didn't grow up like I did, then you don't know. And if you don't know, it's probably better you don't judge. You don't know the hold our mothers have on us, even the ones that are never around, especially the ones that are never around. What it's like to be the perfect Dominican daughter, which is just a nice way of saying a perfect Dominican slave. You don't know what it's like to grow up with a mother who never said a positive thing in her life, not about her children or the world, who was always suspicious, always tearing you down and splitting your dreams straight down the seams. When my first pen pal, Tomoko, stopped writing me after 3 letters, she was the one who laughed. "You think someone's going to lose life writing to you?" Of course I cried. I was 8, and I had already planned that Tomoko and her family would adopt me. My mother, of course, saw clean into the marrow of those dreams and laughed. "I wouldn't write to you either," she said. She was that kind of mother, who makes you doubt yourself, who would wipe you out if you let her. But I'm not going to pretend either. For a long time, I let her say what she wanted about me. And what was worse, for a long time, I believed her. I was a fea. I was a worthless. I was an idiota. From ages 2 to 13, I believed her. And because I believed her, I was the perfect hija. I was the one cooking, cleaning, doing the wash, buying groceries, writing letters to the bank to explain why a house payment was going to be late, translating. I had the best grades in my class. I never caused trouble, even when the morenos used to come after me with scissors because of my straight hair. I stayed at home and made sure Oscar was fed and that everything ran right while she was at work. I raised him, and I raised me. I was the one. You're my hija, she said. That's what you're supposed to be doing. When that thing happened to me when I was 8 and I finally told her what he had done, she told me to shut my mouth and stop crying. And I did exactly that. I shut my mouth and clenched my legs and my mind, and within a year, I couldn't have told you what that neighbor looked like or even his name. All you do is complain, she said to me. But you have no idea what life really is. Sí, señora. When she told me that I could go on my 6th grade sleepaway to Bear Mountain, and I bought a backpack with my own paper route money, and wrote Bobby Santos notes because he was promising to break into my cabin and kiss me in front of everyone, I believed her. And when on the morning of the trip she announced that I wasn't going, I said, "But you promised." And she said, "Muchacha del Diablo, I promised you nothing." I didn't throw my backpack at her or pull out my eyes. And when it was Laura Sáenz who ended up kissing Bobby Santos, not me, I didn't say anything either. I just lay in my room with my stupid bear and sang under my breath, imagining where I would run away to when I grew up. To Japan, maybe, where I would track down Tomoko, or to Austria, where my singing would inspire a remake of The Sound of Music. All my favorite books from that period were about runaways. Watership Down, The Incredible Journey, My Side of the Mountain. And when Bon Jovi's Runaway came out, I imagined it was me they were singing about. No one had any idea. I was the tallest, dorkiest girl in the school, the one who dressed up as Wonder Woman every Halloween, the one who never said a word. People saw me in my glasses and my hand-me-down clothes and could not have imagined what I was capable of. And then when I was 12, I got that feeling, the scary, witchy one. And before I knew it, my mother was sick, and the wildness that had been in me all along, that I tried to tamp down with chores and with homework and with promises that once I reached college I would be able to do whatever I pleased, burst out. I couldn't help it. I tried to keep it down, but it just flooded through all my quiet spaces. It was a message more than a feeling. A message that tolled like a bell. Change, change, change. It didn't happen overnight. Yes, the wildness was in me. Yes, it kept my heart beating fast all the long day. Yes, it danced around me while I walked down the street. Yes, it let me look boys straight in the face when they stared at me. Yes, it turned my laugh from a cough into a long wild fever. But I was still scared. How could I not be? I was my mother's daughter. Her hold on me stronger than love. And then one day I was walking home with Karen Cepeda, who at that time was like my friend. Karen did the goth thing really well. She had spiky Robert Smith hair and wore all black and had the skin color of a ghost. Walking with her and Patterson was like walking with the bearded lady. Everybody would stare, and it was the scariest thing, and that was, I guess, why I did it. We were walking down Main and being stared at by everybody, and out of nowhere I said, "Karen, I want you to cut my hair." As soon as I said it, I knew. The feeling in my blood, the rattle, came over me again. Karen raised her eyebrow. "What about your mother?" You see, it wasn't just me. Everybody was scared of Belicia de Leon. "Fuck her," I said. Karen looked at me like I was being stupid. I never cursed, but that was something else that was about to change. The next day we locked ourselves in her bathroom, and downstairs her father and uncles were bellowing at some soccer game. "Well, how do you want it?" she asked. I looked at the girl in the mirror for a long time. All I knew was that I didn't want to see her ever again. I put the clippers in Karen's hand, turned them on, and guided her hand until it was all gone. "So now you're punk?" Karen asked uncertainly. "Yes," I said. The next day my mother threw the wig at me. "You're going to wear this. You're going to wear it every day, and if I see you without it on, I'm going to kill you." I didn't say a word. I held the wig over the burner. "Don't do it," she swore as the burner clicked. "Don't you dare." It went up in a flash, like gasoline, like a stupid hope, and if I hadn't thrown it in the sink, it would have taken my hand. The smell was horrible, like all of the chemicals from all the factories in Elizabeth. That was when she slapped me, when I struck her hand and she snatched it back, like I was the fire. Of course, everyone thought I was the worst daughter ever. My tía and our neighbors kept saying, "Hija, she's your mother, she's dying." But I wouldn't listen. When I caught her hand, a door opened, and I wasn't about to turn my back on it. But God, how we fought. Sick or not, dying or not, my mother wasn't going to go down easily. She wasn't una pendeja. I'd seen her slap grown men, push white police officers onto their asses, curse a whole group of bochincheras. She had raised me and my brother by herself. She had worked 3 jobs until she could buy this house we live in. She had survived being abandoned by my father. She had come from Santo Domingo all by herself, and as a young girl she claimed to have been beaten, set on fire, left for dead. There was no way she was going to let me go without killing me first. "Figurín de mierda," she called me. "You think you're someone, but you ain't nada." She dug hard, looking for my seams, wanting me to tear like always. But I didn't weaken. I wasn't going to. It was that feeling I had, that my life was waiting for me on the other side, that made me fearless. When she threw away my Smiths and Sisters of Mercy posters, "Aquí yo no quiero maricones," I bought replacements. When she threatened to tear up my new clothes, I started keeping them in my locker and at Karen's house. When she told me that I had to quit my job at the Greek diner, I explained to my boss that my mother was starting to lose it because of her chemo, so when she called to say I couldn't work there anymore, he just handed me the phone and stared out at his customers in embarrassment. When she changed the locks on me, I had started staying out late, going to the limelight, because even though I was 14, I looked 25. I would knock on Oscar's window, and he would let me in, scared because the next day my mother would run around the house screaming, "Who the hell let that hija de la gran puta in the house? Who? Who?" And Oscar would be at the breakfast table, stammering, "I don't know, mommy. I don't." Her rage filled the house, flat, stale smoke. It got into everything, into our hair and our food, like the fallout they talked to us about in school that would one day drift down soft as snow. My brother didn't know what to do. He stayed in his room, though sometimes he would lamely try to ask me what was going on. "Nothing. You can tell me, Lola," he said, and I could only laugh. "You need to lose weight," I told him. In those final weeks, I knew better than to walk near my mother. Most of the time, she just looked at me with the stink eye, but sometimes, without warning, she would grab me by my throat and hang on until I pried her fingers from me. She didn't bother talking to me unless it was to make death threats. "When you grow up, you'll meet me in a dark alley when you least expect it, and then I'll kill you, and nobody will know I did it." Literally gloating as she said this. "You're crazy," I told her. "You don't call me crazy," she said, and then she sat down, panting. It was bad, but no one expected what came next. So obvious when you think about it. All my life I'd been swearing that one day I would just disappear. And one day, I did. I ran off, dique, because of a boy. What can I really tell you about him? He was like all boys, beautiful and callow, and like an insect he couldn't sit still. Un blanquito with long hairy legs I met one night at Limelight. His name was Aldo. He was 19 and lived down at the Jersey Shore with his 74-year-old father. In the back of his Oldsmobile on University, I pulled my leather skirt up and my fishnet stockings down, and the smell of me was everywhere. That was our first date. The spring of my sophomore year, we wrote and called each other at least once a day. I even drove down with Karen to visit him in Wildwood. She had a license, I didn't. He lived and worked near the boardwalk, one of three guys who operated the bumper cars, the only one without tattoos. "You should stay," he told me that night, while Karen walked ahead of us on the beach.